Here we go. Who are you and why are you here?
I'm Will Hilgenberg with Albatross Bikes, and we're here to show off our new Apogee module, which is our new suspension platform, as well as some of our road and hardtail offerings that we already have in line.
Cool. Well, you've been around a few years. You've been really into the low stay thing for a while, trying to get some compliance in the rear, obviously, and you went all in suddenly, seemingly in my mind out of nowhere with this modular rear end, which, you know, looking at it online, it looked like, you know, pretty renders, and you're like, oh, that looks really dope, but this is probably a render or something like that, studio shot. And here we are in front of it, and it looks just as good as it does in real life as it does there. And definitely congratulations. You know, I've been watching Trinity do their thing, and I'm a little happier seeing yours than theirs in terms of what's going on. Certainly there's issues with both and all that stuff, and we can get into that, but it looks killer. How's
thank
that?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's we may have gone a little overboard on this prototype, just on the finish and making sure it's all dialed, but that kind of comes down and speaks to the way that we really want to have the refinement in the bikes, and as we continue, it's like, if this is how good a prototype is, like, can't wait until summer 24.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a totally worked out finished product. I mean, I don't know how it works mechanically and all that stuff, but like from a presentation level, it looks gorgeous.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Now, like, what problem, you know, I like to talk about engineering-y type stuff.
Yeah.
What problem were you trying to solve, like, in a very specific way?
There's two problems that we've been wanting to solve with this module. The first of which is wanting to ensure that bikes last a long time. And that's
in terms of keeping up with the changes around them.
Exactly, yeah. So we wanted to have a bike that was able to be adapted to the changes in the industry, as well as the changes in the riders. As riders develop, as riders change over the years, they want to have something that can work with them. And instead of buying a new bike, instead of building a new frame from the ground up, what we're able to do is work within the modular system and swap some components out for them.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it looks like there's a bunch of room for that and different stuff. What's your background? You're probably a mechanical engineer of some kind or whatever. You're fairly young. What got you here?
So my background has actually been, my education was in aeronautical engineering down at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and ended up in the bike industry. So worked at Specialized, worked at Praxis, worked at Bell Helmets, Ibis, and then at this point, it's like I wanted to kind of go out on my own and try my own hand at working in the bike industry with my own company. So that's where we are today.
Okay, yeah. I mean, and were you part of the Cal Poly bike group because they've made their rounds?
I was right at the start of the Cal Poly frame builders and didn't quite catch them while they were in their full swing and building bikes the whole time, but I was in the machine shop. I worked as the CNC coordinator at the Cal Poly machine shops as they were kind of getting everything going.
Right, yeah. I've spoken with many alumni and current members at times of the Cal Poly group, and it's quite a scene, and I think it's a great thing, and obviously, especially when we see the faces later that talk about Cal Poly and talk about being in that shop and doing all that stuff. It's a tribute to the university.
They've done a really good job with their learn by doing ethos and how they're trying to educate their students and making sure that all the students go out into the workforce with a very hands-on, tangible experience with what they're designing, which, as I'm sure you can understand, is engineering students need to have that hands-on experience in order to design things well.
They have to. And if the school doesn't do that, I mean, I'm at a CSU and we don't do that. And I have a big problem with that. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And Cal Poly is obviously a great example of how to do it right.
Yeah. But we're biased, right?
Of course. Yeah. So you worked in the bike industry, like, say, Specialized, name brand companies. What were you doing at those companies specifically from an engineering point of view?
So at Specialized, that was my first job out of, actually, I was still in college at that point, so I helped them design their wind tunnel. That was the background.
Because you had aeronautical engineering
exactly.
Training.
Yeah. So helped them design the wind tunnel. Then I went to Praxis. Their WaveTech chain rings, the bottom bracket, helped with the cranks, did a lot of the wheel design with Praxis.
The first bottom bracket that made my eyes roll?
The second bottom bracket.
Oh, the one that might have worked?
Yes. No, they all worked. It's just a question of what the frame was doing.
I'm just being bitter.
Oh, I know. But, yeah, so worked on the second iteration of that, kind of helped progress that, and decided to move on into helmets as well.
Uh-huh.
That was Bell Helmets, the Moto 10, couple other products that were not released. That was where I was working on and developing those products.
Were you living in Santa Cruz or Aptos or Morgan Hill or wherever?
Santa Cruz and Bonnie Doon as well. Uh-huh. So just kind of up in the hills, as close to the trails as I could get.
Yeah. Are you a mountain biker by heart?
I am. I'm actually a motorcycle rider. Okay. from early stages, and then picked up mountain biking later in life.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the foothills of California, so Auburn area.
Okay, not a bad place for either motorcycling or mountain biking.
When you can do a dual sport ride to and from high school, it's a pretty good place to live.
Yeah, that definitely builds some base in the understanding of what we're doing here.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you're doing, you know, I think I've started following you a while back, maybe your first frame or two. I don't know if I sent you an email or not, but
yeah, I'm not sure if we have.
Can't remember, but you know, you've been really working on that low seat stay thing.
Yeah,
and like absurdly and dramatically low compared to most.
Yeah.
And you were probably ahead of the curve in terms of that from a fashion point of view.
Yeah.
But you were trying to do something mechanically with your passive flex there. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Absolutely. So you spoke earlier about having that core problem to solve from an engineering standpoint. And what we wanted to do is question like the underlying assumptions of why hardtails and why these double diamond frames exist. For years, it comes from a roadside where you want to have the lightest, you want to have the stiffest frame possible, and the double diamond configuration is a fantastic answer for that. So I wanted to kind of ask the question of, like, what if we wanted to design for something else, what would it look like? And in our case, we wanted to design for more traction and more comfort in the rider. And that's where, as we started developing, dropping the stays lower and lower, making the structural side of it actually work, kind of bypassing the seat tube, dropping it lower onto the down tube, like all these different things came around in order to pursue an increase in traction and an increase in comfort for the rider. So the best way that I would probably describe one of our hardtails is it's like going up a tire size when it comes to the cushioned impacts. When you like you find a square edge root or a square edge rock on a hardtail, it feels like you've gone up a tire size, but you also have a degree more of torsional flex, like pure torsional flex, which gives you a lot better drive when you're out of the saddle pedaling. Something that I think we've all experienced where you're out of the saddle pedaling and the tire starts slipping on kind of dry kitty litter over hardback. Right. This bike doesn't do that. It grips. It just basically squats and goes. It's a bit of a surreal feeling and something I didn't really believe until I started handing it off to other people, and they kind of backed up the same assertions there. So,
right. Yeah. There's interesting things of different types of flex and different types of ways a bike works that might have been termed problematic in the past. Like, you know, I started mountain biking in the very late 80s.
Yeah.
And everything was about stiff, 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 stiff. And it's like, if you looked at my mountain bikes now, they're not stiff in certain ways. And that's because, you know, you need the bike to flex a lot if you want to have traction, especially when it's leaned over.
Exactly.
I mean, this is classic motorcycle chassis design stuff.
Right. Yeah. It's like you have Ducati MotoGP. They went way far into their super stiff chassis and realized that this is not the right answer. Stoner's the only one who can ride it.
Right.
So back that off. And now we're seeing companies like KTM with full steel trellis frames and MotoGP. I mean, I've heard of my grandfather was a crew chief on AMA racing side.
Oh, cool.
So that's kind of speaking to a lot of that.
I used to work at Factory Pro with Mark Salvesberg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Racing's fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll go off onto a big tangent on motorcycles later. Yeah. But, it's just trying to understand what flex is good flex, and what's positive for the rider, what helps them achieve the experience that they want to achieve.
Right, yeah. I mean, we're in total agreement there. Actually, I'm pretty emphatically on Onyx hubs.
Okay.
And yeah, one of the first things people might notice when they get on the Onyx hubs, other than how dreamily quiet they are and all the instant engagement, is unlike a ratchet hub, there's no dead stop for power engagement.
Right.
There's a slight wind up. And some people would be like, that's bad. It's like, actually, I'm pretty sure it's a really good thing that it softens that initial engagement. It doesn't steal anything from you,
right,
but it softens that initial engagement, which I think probably contributes to much more traction in the trickiest of places, that you're not just hitting it like that. You're softening into it, and that's flex in a mechanical drive system that might be good. I mean, kind of like a cush drive on a motorcycle.
I was going to say, we've seen cush drives in motorcycles since the 60s,
right,
maybe 50s.
Without the cush drive, they just break chains or swing arms.
Exactly, yeah. I know I don't have that much power, so I don't need it for that. But, yeah, it definitely helps to kind of soften that torque delivery that we have. I mean, you have a crank. You can apply power at one portion of that phase, so it is kind of a peaky power delivery.
Sure.
So, yeah, if you can figure out a way to kind of work with that, right, and design to those demands, then...
Like we say, I mean, as a designer or an engineer or anything in these bike spaces, we're playing with marginal gains lots of times.
Absolutely.
I mean, the difference between a fantastic bike and a garbage bike is very nuanced oftentimes.
Yeah.
And, like, you have to really know what you're looking for and talking about, and most people might not even recognize that difference sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's trying to work within a little bit of the nuances to achieve what the rider is doing. I mean, that is the core of what we do. We want to make sure that the rider can achieve the experience that they want to have.
Right.
And the bike is a tool to do that.
Okay, before we talk more about the brand new girlfriend here, let's talk just a little bit about your native CAD environment. What were you doing in, say, high school and college versus at some of the various companies, and what environment do you prefer to be working in?
So high school, actually, that was pre-CAD for a lot of things for me. But I did a lot of hand drafting, and I think that's actually one of the core things for me has been being able to draft things by hand and understand them from a physical standpoint as you draw them out, draw sections, helps your design process. Going from there, throughout college, I worked in SolidWorks. I worked in Wildfire.
Wildfire? I haven't heard of that.
All right. It's Creo before it was Creo.
Oh, funny. Okay.
PTC Wildfire.
All right. I wasn't paying attention to PTC for a long time, and people are talking about Creo for a lot now.
Right.
But in large part, PTC vanished after being the shit, and then they vanish. And then there's Creo. I don't know.
Exactly.
But there was Wildfire somewhere in there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was the in-between. But, Creo, CATIA, SolidWorks, a little bit of Fusion. It's not my preferred, but we can do it.
It seems like people that are used to SolidWorks or CATIA-type environments don't mix well with Fusion 360 in general.
It's just a different way of modeling,
sure,
right? It has a very low barrier to entry, which I think is fantastic. Gets more people interested in engineering. It kind of supports the STEM aspect of a lot of these schools, and they've done a great job of pushing it. And I think their CAM package for CNC is fantastic. I used to use it with SolidWorks, the HSM works.
I know a lot of people that get Fusion 360 just for CAM.
Right.
They don't even touch it for design and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, I like to talk about modeling methodologies and kind of CAD nerd out on stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've done full chassis and you've done the suspension module type thing.
Yeah.
So you know about designing the whole bike, you know about designing parts of the bike. And what, if you can put into words your modeling environment, how do you approach parts and assemblies, and how do you deal with some of the equations that come up or some of the geometries and things like that? Like, have you nerded out on the, like I just switched to a master part modeling scheme and I hadn't done that before, and I converted everything over, and I'm starting to see some benefits, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And all that, and it's like, you know, I've used several other methodologies for the overarching thing of how to get the results. Is there a way you could put into words kind of your approach to the part and assembly interactions and all that as we get into parametric structures and things?
Yeah, so I think the technical descriptor of kind of how I would model that stuff is from a very top-down approach. So you start with a skeleton file and a master assembly and start building out sub-assemblies and kind of all keyed to that same skeleton file, which is holding all your datums that you need, your axes, your basic kinematic layouts. And what that allows you to do is you can have a little bit more flexibility in how you're designing the parts, how you're actually having all those parts interact with each other, but still based to that same underlying structure. And so with that skeleton model, like when it comes to customizing some of our frames, what we're able to do is drop in a new skeleton file, and our models snap to that new file. Everything, hopefully, if it's not too far out of bounds.
Lose fillets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fillets disappear. But everything is pretty much, I'd say 90% of the work is done. And that carries into all your drawings, everything. So if you spend the time early on in order to lay out the model the way it needs to be for future development, it makes the whole process much faster. It does take more time. You do have to think it through. You do have to, like, I actually map out the entire assembly structure and which, like, where I want to draw divides between different sub-assemblies prior to actually starting all of it, because if you have you spend all that time up front, you end up with a much cleaner tree long term, and something that breaks far less often.
I'd love to get to cleaner trees myself. Like, so, like on a part level, like especially with 3D, additive feature trees have just ballooned to unimaginable sizes. Do you like equations, or are you part sketch based solving?
Much more sketch based. So I'm pretty graphical in how I process things. So for me, an equation is handy, and there are times where, yeah, I'll use them because they're very applicable. They'll generate the geometry that I want. But with a lot of the different morphologies that we're working with too, trying to adapt, like create an equation. By the time you add enough variables into the equation, I find it's easier to just move a sketch and make those adjustments that way. That is a personal preference. Everyone has their own way of doing it.
Well, I can't argue it's easier. I mean, I think I do it the hard way, but I'm trying to do something some people aren't trying to do, you know, sometimes.
Right. We do use equations for the initial analysis of the geometry. So we actually work with the Patterson method and as a control law in order to...
The Patterson method? Tell me about that.
So the Patterson method, Bill Patterson was a scholar, I will call him. And this is kind of going back to Cal Poly.
Sure.
He was a professor at Cal Poly who developed this control law method of applying three-dimensional or multi-dimensional, I should say, control law theory from aircraft to a ground vehicle, and using that to describe your motion of your bike and predict your outcome of the geometry that you provide.
Huh, interesting. Like, you know, going further than 6 degrees with longitude, latitude, roll, pitch, yaw type stuff.
Right.
But further than that, in terms of defining, having the geometry shaped by the path of the vehicle?
Somewhat. I would say it's more of you're trying to, as you apply the control law to a ground vehicle and a rolling ground vehicle, because that's always been a problem with ground vehicle dynamics in application to two-wheeled vehicles, is it's a very dynamic system.
Yeah, you have a greater degree of freedom.
It's like we were just talking about motorcycles, yeah. And it's like, yeah, you could try to solve it, but you're not going to.
No. No, and that's what this does, is it gives you a good representative comparison of different geometries. So if our customer comes to us and says, I've ridden Cannondales, I've ridden Specialized, I've ridden Cervelos, I like these bikes, but I only like the handling at high speed of this. I like the low speed geometry of this. And
Boy, I wish I could talk to these people because they don't sound like the people I end up talking to.
It's not. It's never in so many words. You have to tease it out, and that's right. That's sure. the art of
dealing with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. That's the customer service side of it. Yeah. Is understanding. It's like, okay, I have to translate what someone is feeling, how the experience that they want into these discrete design goals, and so. By kind of talking through, like, oh, how did you like your previous bikes? What we're able to do is we'll build a library of each of those bikes, look at their handling curves, see where they may be sensitive at lower speed or the control force at the handlebars higher, and be able to tune our geometry to work within that.
Okay. Well, hopefully I just learned something awesome. I'm going to look into it in the next week or two.
Absolutely.
And see what's there. And, you know, sometimes it might be stuff I've seen before and whatever. But I'm going to look it up because I don't recognize it right away. Okay, so let's talk about, what do you call this system? I mean, the bike is the Apogee, but, like, what is the system itself name?
So the Albatross Apogee module is kind of that core piece of the suspension that you're seeing here, the gunmetal alloy centerpiece. And so what we've done is we've taken all of the tight tolerance suspension components, pulled them out of the traditional...
The weldment. Frame.
Yeah. So we're basically trying to simplify the weldment into a machined assembly where we can control the tolerances. We know everything's going to go roughly.
Well, anybody that's designed a suspension system, I've designed a few that live virtually in my machine but haven't been made. In certain configurations of designs, a half a millimeter suddenly makes it not work, and things like that. So when we talk about welded systems, there are designs that you simply can't hold what you need to hold, and this does solve for that, in that you can handle designs that tiny, tiny differences are held on your bike.
Exactly. Yeah, so by running those really precise tolerances, what we've been able to do is have a free float kinematic that is very adaptable and very adjustable. So
Suzuki called it full floater.
Exactly. Yeah, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So
well, then then Trek thought they were going to hashtag that shit.
Yep.
Now you got it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. It's, again, moto background, right?
Right.
So yeah, that's and nothing. There's only so many ways to connect a shock to...
Oh, yeah. It's all been done. It's all been done.
Yeah, with this free-float kinematic that we have, what we're able to do is make adjustments. And within this within this module, what we're able to do is have a platform that can run 120 out to 150, I think is where we're limiting it at the moment. And as we develop and continue to refine this, we'll be able to kind of stretch those bounds a little bit and see where we can go. But what this allows us to do is have a very modular system where if you wanted to run 120, like, we have a rocker set up for that. Drop them in, you're good to go.
So it's kind of like a couple rocker parts and that does it.
At this time, yes.
So the motorcycle guys are saying you need a new dog bone.
Exactly, right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I need a little lowering length.
Yeah. Lowering length, that helps my system work better.
So much better, right?
Yeah.
So basically with this whole module, we're able to make everything much more compact.
It's a very tight package. It's impressive.
Since we're on the over the magic of radio right here, it's about the size of a water bottle. Uh-huh. So it's very compact. It allows you to have a lot more freedom for the front triangle. So you're able to accommodate different geometries. You're able to have a little bit more design freedom. If you wanted to put a bike packing bag in there, there's a lot of room for that. There's room for two water bottles inside.
There's a huge amount of room, but also as a constructor, it utterly simplifies the front end part of the equation. And if the rear end is a part of a kit, or even there's a lot of simplification for rear end construction also, and it's like you kind of have packaged anything hard about making a full suspension bike into a unit, and everything else from a chassis guy's point of view is as easy as building any other bike.
Exactly.
Or some maybe even easier.
Yeah, we always want to make the machine do the hard part.
Yeah.
So I don't have to.
Right,
I'm lazy.
I hate building bikes. I do.
And yet we can't stop, right?
Well, I want what I want.
Yeah.
I'm determined.
So, yeah, that's really what we've been able to do is allow the different methodologies for manufacture to be good at what they're good at doing. So your front triangle, yeah, it's easy. You have a fixture that goes into your traditional frame fixture, and you're able to build a front triangle that bolts to this complex assembly that you're
just like everybody's kind of already doing with e-bike motors.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very similar to how you would build a pinion gearbox, an e-bike motor, anything that has that bottom bracket module. Build it the same way.
Yeah. There's so many nice things about it, other than also how good it looks. And this is early. You know, we're.
It is a prototype.
Like, sure, it's a prototype. It's hard to talk about it as a prototype because it does look so finished and clean.
Yeah,
it's quite nice. And the thing is, it's like when I make a prototype, it doesn't look like this. I hate talking about kinematics because generally when I do, people have no idea what they're talking about, or what they're saying. But I think it's worth talking about in this case, since you've bent over backwards from a packaging and focusing on ease of use, essentially, for building it in and fixing things later or changing things later. There's probably some things in the kinematics that maybe aren't optimal or are there that maybe need explaining that you should maybe talk about.
Absolutely. So as you take any kinematic, squash it down, make it as compact as possible, your tolerances become even more important. And so that's why we've been partnering with the engineering company to really refine the process, make sure that everything is done correctly in production, to make sure that we have the kinematics that we design to the tolerances that we need to produce the experience that we need. The other challenge that you can see by making everything compact is your forces go up. So you're not resolving those forces over a large distance, which is a part of the challenge. But what we've been able to do is create a very robust structure to support those loads. And we've been partnering with Enduro Bearings as well, who've been fantastic at making bearings specifically for bicycles, which bearings are the traditional bearings that you'd expect.
They've been singing your praises this week on the socials.
I very much appreciate that. So, I've worked with them in the past too. They're fantastic. I mean, the way they approach their design problems, and we'll have a talk later today on Friday at 2 p.m. about some of their design process as well as how we've worked with them to design this module. So some of those problems is that as everything gets more compact, it puts a lot more load on because we have that shock floating, there's two points that it's mounted to, and so your loads increase there, and it becomes a more of a challenge to make sure that everything stays very robust and durable long term. So that's why we've specifically worked with Enduro to make sure that the bearing spec is correct, make sure that the grease spec in the bearings, the ABEC rating, everything is dialed to make sure that this system is robust and lasts a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, from a bearing point of view, and I've talked with Enduro and everything like that. They're local-ish to me. Where are you now, actually?
So we're up in Seattle, Washington.
Okay, so you're out of the Bay Area or South Bay or whatever.
We're in the North Bay.
Okay.
North
and Bay. So you would understand one of my biggest problems with bearings in general on a bike is washout and waterproofing those suckers. Because, I mean, hopefully you'll be sealing your bearings as well, actual seals, not bicycle marketing seals.
Yeah.
Because that helps a huge up. But that washout problem, in my mind, is the number one problem in bearings rather than even peak load type of stuff.
Yeah, so that goes back to kind of the experiences that I've had in the past of making sure that ABEC rating is good, your grease spec is absolutely solid for the rate of which you're spinning your environment that you're in and full contact seals. Like, yes, they'll take a little bit to break in. That initial feel is not going to be that free spinning, like for crank bearings, for example. When you spin a crank and it spins forever, it's like, well, that's great, but that means your seals are not sealing. That means they're hovering over where they should be. They're not sealing.
In the skateboard world, kids like to spin their wheels.
Yeah.
And I say, that's great. You found out how your wheel works when you're not on it.
Exactly.
Sweet.
So, yeah, it's like with Enduro, making sure that the seals are right, the grease is right, the ABEC spec is right, and our tolerances in the bearing press fits are right. We're making sure that we're going through everything that we can to ensure a very long, durable product.
Now, just philosophically on a kinematic curve level type stuff, what it was your goal and maybe where did you end up?
So we're developing a linear progressive kinematic.
A linear progressive digressive somewhat...
Okay,
collapsing.
Are we talking wheel rate?
It's nimble. It's
exactly. So we're designing, like, in terms of just as a product, we're designing to work with an air shock and also to be developing kinematic, those actual leverage ratios to work with coil as well. Those are two separate.
Very lightly progressive.
Exactly. Yeah. And what that all allows to do is have that degree of flexibility. There are some other products that you may see showing up in a couple weeks, maybe a month, that we're can't really speak to, but it definitely makes all of this make even more sense. And so when that comes around, I'll be happy to reach out to you.
All right, cool.
And point to it. But it's something we're working with companies in the bike industry to make sure that this is a good, well-rounded product that works with their products the way that it needs to. Because there's, like, as you're well aware, it's very easy to design things in a way that doesn't work with the products as they were designed.
Sure, sure. I mean, honestly, I don't, you know, personally see where coil belongs on this bike at all. And I think most people don't understand what they have to do to use coils.
Yeah.
How's this? It's like, I mean, I talk about the spring rating and stuff like that. And like in motorsport, springs are typically come in within 1%. They're guaranteed within 2%, and they're typically within 1% of rated value. In the bicycle industry, they guarantee within 15%, and they're often upwards of 25 to 30% off.
Yep.
And that's of marked rated value. So you have so much tuning overlap that it becomes almost impossible to tune without actually rating your own springs.
True.
And then the actual understanding of suspension most people have can't deal with that. And then they make the mistake of buying a titanium spring. And then now they're so invested in the wrong spring that they run it anyway.
Right.
And stuff like that. And I think for most people, the AirShock simply is the correct choice. And springs really only show up in top level downhill and enduro, which your bike's probably not.
Correct.
And to optimize a system for use with spring, kind of, it makes the kids on pink bike happy, but the thing is, they aren't really the ones that matter.
True. That is a very good approach to that. And if you're going to run the numbers and make sure that everything is to the number correct, then absolutely, you're 100% right. The tolerances on the springs can be much greater. The way that the industry has typically approached this is not as maybe... doesn't have the same rigor as a Penske or a Multimatic would have in this application. But for the coil shock, I'll admit that's more of something for me personally.
Sure.
I do prefer coils. I do prefer the way they ride. That off-the-top feeling is really good. Air springs have gotten much better.
Sure.
And so as the air spring, I mean, you look at damper technology, or spring technology.
Don't want to mix the two.
Right. Yeah.
Look at the spring technology, how the seals have improved, how the stiffness of the shock, unfortunately, has had to improve. There's been a lot of strides there, and so we actually have an air shock here at the show. We just didn't bolt it up, but that will be something that is makes a lot more sense for the customer.
With your design, could I, in fact, let's say, would you have say 120?
Yeah.
Say you're doing 120s. Could I get a progressive link set versus a more linear link set at that same travel? Is that something you're able to or thinking about doing, or is it like kind of like, no, that stuff is not part of that?
We're protecting for that in the design.
Okay.
So right now we're again, this is early in the refinement phase, so we're still...
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant more linear for air shocks rather than more progressive. I just didn't want the internet to beat me up, you know?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So we're developing for the air shock and the coil shock, both. Whether we'll see kind of which one we prefer, which one will be able to deliver the experience that we're looking for the customers. And again, like, because this is a custom bike, we will be able to offer both of those. Mm-hmm. If you prefer an air shock, we can change the rocker for that. If you prefer a coil shock, we can make that happen too. Comes down to the customer and what they want at the end of the day.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of these things of what you're saying and stuff is very cool stuff to hear. It's a very neat idea, especially for someone who just wants to make rad bikes and doesn't want to, you know, spend 2 years in the shop just to get that one bike, even though I spent a lot of time in the shop, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But you know what I mean? Full suspension bikes are just brutal in terms of the workload if you're trying to do it yourself with all the stuff. Let's see. I don't know. What have I not mentioned that you would think on an engineering level might be worth discussing here? Because I'm generally trying to target a more technical crowd that thinks about things in the real engineering sense.
Cable routing.
Oh, yeah? So what about cable routing here?
Cable routing is one of those things that always seems to get pushed to the last minute. And so we're running all of our cable routing internally, which will allow us to be better able to actually put together like a skid plate on the outside or to protect against more of the mud intrusion, because right now it is a very skeletal open frame.
I was going to talk about that, yeah. But I'll let you bring it up.
Oh, no. It is open. It's out there. It's vulnerable.
Mud is a real factor.
I live in Washington.
Yes. I mean, there's so many suspension bikes that are sold that, one, they don't even have honest seals on their bearings.
Right.
And then, two, have a power wash going the whole time they're riding.
Exactly. And so, for us, it starts with making sure that the bearings are good, tolerances, as we spoke to. But then what we're moving forward with from here is making sure that we can seal the package, make sure we can enclose it and protect it as best we can. But for this first prototype, we wanted to show people this is everything out in the open.
It gets the eyeballs rolling.
It does. And also, like, for testing, if you leave it open, you put it through the worst you can, and you see what happens.
Sure. Cool. I'm excited. It looks cool. It's great. You are definitely on the top of my list of people I wanted to talk to at the show. And I look forward to more and all this. I hope it really works out.
Thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time. And, for anyone listening, I really encourage you to go to our website, kind of subscribe to our newsletter, go to the Apogee module, drop down to the bottom, it's right there. And what we're going to be doing is bringing everyone along with the process and doing monthly updates on where we are, going into the details of why the design is where it is, how we've gotten there, and bring everyone along for the ride.
And when do you kind of just roughly forecast a release, and are you planning on making this available for frame builders?
So our target is 2024, for summer 2024 for this bike, for release for our own use. And the conversation around, will it be used for other frame builders? That's a conversation we've just started having here at the show, starting yesterday. Yeah. So we're open to the idea. We're having conversations, but nothing's actually finalized yet.
That's awesome. I look forward to it all.
Thank you.
Bye.